It's clearly a game changer. If you look at the blockchains themselves, 70% of every blockchain transaction that happens on any given day is a stablecoin being moved. And so you have this insatiable appetite, really, of people outside of the US that can't get access to US bank accounts in a lot of cases that want to store their wealth in dollars.
Welcome back to Voices of Blockchain, the official podcast of Boston Blockchain Week 2025. Today, I'm sitting down with Matt Walsh, founding partner at Castle Island Ventures, an early stage VC firm laser focused on blockchain infrastructure and digital assets. We're breaking down stablecoins' massive role in crypto, the push for regulatory legislation like the Clarity Act, and Matt's journey from Fidelity's crypto pioneers to backing game-changing startups, plus insights from his podcast and why Boston blockchain scene is heating up. So check out Castle Island Ventures at castleisland.vc and tune into On the Brink, link in the description. You can also get your passes for the panels, the founders, and the crypto vibes at bostonblockchainweek.com. Now let's get into it with Matt Walsh. Matt, thanks for joining me from Castle Island Ventures. Is that a VC firm?
That's right. Yeah, we're an early stage venture capital fund focused on the blockchain space.
Not just blockchain, but stablecoins specifically, I believe, right?
All digital asset infrastructure. Stablecoins definitely a killer use case, and we've been very active in the stablecoin space since about 2020.
Okay, I'm going to have some questions for you about stablecoins, but before we do that, though, I have just met, I think it was yesterday, I recorded with Josh Deems, and I was talking to him a little bit about some of the history of Fidelity, and he asked me if I'd met you yet. So I heard that you're the guy who actually hired Josh?
Well, I think I referred him in. Yeah, he got himself hired.
He tells it a little bit differently. He says he met you at like a cafeteria or something. You guys had lunch together.
We were lucky to get Josh to come over from State Street. They weren't doing much at the time in the blockchain space, so it was a good hire.
Well, I got to say, so you were VP over at Fidelity Investments you're basically the head of the blockchain end or second in charge?
I wouldn't say I was the head of it. I was part of this small team that started looking at Bitcoin back in 2014, originally through the lens of this being a disruptive technology that could have a big impact on financial services. So spent a couple years on the research and development side trying to figure out what this thing was. Obviously, a lot happened over those years. Ethereum launched and started to see new use cases beyond just Bitcoin for payments. And that culminated with starting a small fund under Fidelity's umbrella. And we later left Fidelity to start Castle Island, really to expand the strategy. And we invest in early stage infrastructure businesses a lot in the financial services space.
Man, the more I read and hear and talk to you, like some of the early founders and the guys who've been in this space for a long time, like I've really been impressed with how many, lives it seems that like Fidelity has touched. Like I think the term that I heard was the Fidelity Crypto Mafia is what you guys used to call yourselves.
Is that right? Yeah, I think that came a little bit after, but it was a great place to learn. And I'd say Fidelity had way before I joined there, had a very deep history of embracing disruptive technologies. So Fidelity was very early to even things like 1-800 numbers. So calling up and using those. Fidelity was very early to check writing out of money market funds and very early to the internet itself. So in a lot of ways, the blockchain exploration was no different than a lot of other technologies that came before. So it was great. It was an awesome place to really dig into an emerging technology, not really with the idea of going out and making money on it right away, but just really trying to understand it.
Man, hats off to Fidelity. It's really hard to be a big company and still stay that cutting edge, I think, or at least that quick to respond to innovation.
Yeah, I'd say having a long-term focus and not having to optimize every quarter around, okay, we need to make money on something right away. You're just, we need to understand something. We need to go deep. We need to talk to experts. And back then, 2014, Bitcoin was viewed, I would say, more as a payments technology, whereas now it's viewed more as digital gold. And it's a lot more obvious now than it was back in 2014 what people wanted Bitcoin for. And so we were looking at this through the lens of, could this be good for payments? Could this be good for post-trade settlement? And just having those years of really trying to get deep into the technology, understand how it worked, understand the communities also behind it, how this was going to evolve, I would say that was tremendously beneficial.
What do you mean by that? That understanding the community, like, what did that involve? Did that mean like going out and getting your hands dirty and like meeting people in the streets? Or are you talking about like founders? Like,
yeah, like talking to the Bitcoin core developers, even talking to the people that are actually pushing code and actually building Bitcoin. You know, back then, you could go out and talk to these people very easily. A lot of them actually, you know, were hanging out at MIT at the time in the media lab. And so people were very accessible. And it's a phenomenal community in the blockchain space where people are generally very eager to share what they know. And so we would bring these folks in and we would have lunch with them and they would make presentations around, all right, here's where I see the future going. Not all of those things happened, but, you know,
but
we
enough
formed,
of them did.
Enough of them did. And ultimately we're talking about public blockchains in a lot of ways are religions. And, you know, when you see people leave communities within the blockchain space to start new blockchains, they develop this cult following. And I think understanding the human being side of it has always been very important in this space.
Is that why you guys launched the podcast? I mean, congratulations too on passing 650 plus episodes. I mean, that's a no small feat in and of itself.
But
is that what the podcast came about for?
I would say a lot of it was just to meet interesting entrepreneurs. That was really the goal in the early days, is to just go out and speak to as many interesting people as we could and to try to learn out loud. And then we started doing this weekly news roundup episode where we would just talk about what happened that week in the industry, you know, good, bad, or indifferent. And we found that getting out there with our views actually had a tremendous benefit to companies that wanted to eventually work with us and take our capital. And so knowing where we stood on certain issues and, you know, obviously it hasn't always been up and to the right as an industry. There's been some pretty notorious hiccups with, you know, things like FTX and some
Three
of the implosions.
Capital and,
some of the implosions that happened there. And so we were very vocal about some of the bad things that we saw in the industry too. And I think that's helped attract the right type of founder to our orbit, I would say.
Yeah, I don't think you want someone who's just going to be a blind cheerleader. You want somebody who's actually like really trying to think through some of the issues that could potentially be cropping up and planning for ways to, you know, deal with that.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd say this is an industry that is probably shot itself in the foot quite a few times here just with getting ahead of its skis and certain things. Right. So you know, we try to call balls and strikes.
So speaking of that, and stable coins, I guess, as a whole, like you kind of mentioned like the FTC collapse and we mentioned Three Arrows Capital. I remember like one of those being related. There was an issue with a stable coin that was like, it was algorithmically tethered. Is that the right term?
Yeah. A lot of the, a lot of the credit meltdown around Three Arrows was around this asset called Terra in the Luna.
Yes,
So this was an algorithmic stablecoin. And I think that really shined a light on how stablecoins ought to operate. And so it's encouraging to see this current bill that was just passed, the Genius Act, which was just passed into law, prohibits those type of instruments in the United States. And so
So those are gone.
Those are gone. Yeah. So if you want to issue a stable coin in the United States these days, it needs to have a reserve composition that is largely U.S. Treasury bills, as opposed to effectively nothing, which turns out that didn't work.
Does it have to be Treasury bills or can it be any asset that's, I mean, like if you have gold reserves, you should be able to use that, I would think, as long as you have something that should hold its value, right?
Well, you could certainly issue a gold token, but you couldn't call it a U.S. dollar stable coin.
Oh, I see.
And so, you know, this new stablecoin bill has a very clear framework around having T-bills as the backing. You can have some overnight repos, some reverse repo type of things in there as well. But really what you're looking for is treasuries as the base collateral for these things. And I think that makes sense. I think people will experiment with other types of assets. As you point out, gold is something that people appear to have an appetite for. I think real estate will be an interesting asset.
Yep, yep.
Those won't be US dollar stable coins, though. Those will be marketed as something very different and hopefully very clear.
Will they even call it a stable coin at that point, or can they not even use that term either?
I think ultimately a lot of these things will just be either digital commodities or digital securities. And so if you're buying a read on a blockchain, that is a security. You know, if you're buying a token that represents a commodity, maybe that gets regulated under the CFTC. We'll have to see how the market structure bill goes. But importantly, it cannot be advertised as, okay, this is a dollar pegged instrument if it is backed by something like oil or gold or something like that.
I'm really glad that they got rid of that algorithmic thing, because that was the thing that I was like, man, that's just begging for someone to come in and try to break it and liquidate you, right?
Yeah, it didn't last long, it turns out. It broke pretty quickly.
How long did it actually last? Now that you mentioned that,
probably around for about a year before it broke. Okay. There's another asset called Basis, which was a similar concept that never launched, and Terra borrowed a lot of the ideas from that project.
Okay. So the next question I have then is, if you're going to be using fiat currency to back your stablecoin, like, can you still call it DeFi anymore at that point?
Well, I think ultimately you'll have these dollars in circulation and people will use them in centralized interfaces. You'll hold them on Coinbase, hold them on Fidelity, brokerage platforms like that. But there'll also be a thriving DeFi market. And so one of the first use cases actually for stablecoins outside of crypto exchanges, centralized crypto exchanges, was in the DeFi context. And so taking out US dollar loans against Ethereum collateral, things like that. Thriving ecosystem for sure. But yeah, ultimately these stablecoins are issued centrally, right? There's it's very unlike Bitcoin, which does not have a sponsor or a company behind it. Right. These stablecoins are issued by Tether, Circle, eventually many others.
And with the way the Genius Act looked like it was written, is it looks like it makes it easier for banks to kind of, like, the banking industry is going to be the one that's going to be issuing a lot of these going forward, is kind of what it looks like.
I think you'll see large asset managers. I think you'll see banks active in the space as well. I think you'll also see some banks attempt tokenized deposits, things like that. But bigger incumbent financial services firms certainly would be well positioned now that there is that regulatory clarity. And also important that you don't have to go to all 50 states to get bespoke licenses now, which that'll be great for startups that want to engage in the space and they don't have $5 million to spend over 2 years going to all 50 states.
Do you view this then as a positive for the whole, like as a whole?
I think it's clearly a game changer. If you look at the blockchains themselves, 70% of every blockchain transaction that happens on any given day is a stablecoin being moved. And so you have this insatiable appetite, really, of people outside of the U.S. that can't get access to U.S. bank accounts in a lot of cases that want to store their wealth in dollars. And they may live in a jurisdiction that has a rapidly inflating fiat currency. And if they can have an Ethereum wallet... Yeah, Turkey, Argentina, Venezuela, a lot of adoption of stablecoins in Africa. Mm-hmm. So really, we're talking about a technology that proliferates the dollar, that really gives the dollar more strength. And so I think that's a huge positive. And so for the U.S. to lean into that is great. And it will also be great for startups that are building a lot of the infrastructure in and around stablecoins to allow these new entrants, these new issuers to come in, as well as these new use cases. If you just look at what it costs to make a stablecoin remittance payment versus the legacy model, it's a night and day difference. And so I think you'll see these business models in the remittance in the B2B space completely upended by stablecoins.
How different is that? I mean, what is the cost difference?
Well, for one thing, if you think about it as a remittance company, if you're trying to facilitate a transfer without stablecoins, you're talking about tying up capital in local bank accounts wherever you operate. And so customer will onboard in the United States and they will try to offboard to a relative in Mexico, Argentina, wherever. That requires tying up all sorts of capital around the world. With a stablecoin, you're talking about effectively a peer-to-peer transfer that can occur without the need to tie up that capital.
It should be instantaneous at this point.
Right. And so it's at the speed of the blockchain. So you're talking about seconds here. But you're also talking about something that is effectively a bearer instrument when you think about it. And so the asset itself moves as opposed to just this legacy journal entry that requires a cash off-ramp. And so there's no world where it's not a more efficient model. And so just the cost to transact, the cost to the consumer will be a lot lower on these stablecoin rails, not to mention they will operate 24/7, 365, whereas the banks are only open, 9 to 4, probably, right? So you're talking about something that actually works on the nights and the weekends. And I think the analogy of just bringing the speed of the internet to money is probably a good one there.
I like that.
You know, no different than sending an email. You're sending a dollar.
Right. Just used to be send a letter, took 3 days. Now you send an email, it's instantaneous. It's same thing.
Right. It's just sending money instantaneously, you know, ultimately. And of course, you could always do that with something like Bitcoin, but it turns out that a lot of people would just like to store their wealth in dollars.
Well, the hardest thing with Bitcoin is it's so erratic as far as the price goes. Like, I don't think you want a currency to experience more than like even a 1% move in a currency is very rare. I don't think you want to see that in the thing that you're using to transact for, you know, services or goods.
Yeah, Bitcoin is not hyper-optimized as a means of exchange just due to its volatility. And I don't see that changing anytime soon. It's really viewed as, I would say, more of a digital gold, this bet on this emergent store of value. And that obviously has a very important place to play globally as well. But for just moving capital, US dollar stablecoins will be dominant. I expect they'll be dominant in post-trade space in the United States as well, around settling securities transactions and things like that. So I think there's a lot of use cases here, the remittance use case, the DeFi use case taking off now, but the more big financial institutions come into the space, I think the more use cases you'll see around just the traditional financial services world.
Let's talk about getting capital into the companies, because I think that's kind of what you do over at Castle Island Ventures. So what sort of projects are you guys looking at? Like, what sort of things have got you excited for the future?
So we've always had a view that there would be this convergence between traditional financial services and public blockchains. The first thing to really take off was the use case of just buying and storing Bitcoin. And it turns out that there was a lot of infrastructure to invest in and still is around that use case. So investing in compliance software businesses and trading systems and data companies. Over the years, the types of assets that institutions are interested in has certainly evolved. And so starting in about 2020, we went beyond just cryptocurrency infrastructure investments, and we went into stablecoin-related investments. So investing in regional on and off ramps, investing in the types of businesses that will allow you to store your stablecoins easily, these wallet technologies. I think the next wave for us probably is in this tokenized security market. And so the idea that other types of assets, things that exist in the real world, so to speak, will start to become issued on public blockchains. So we see ourselves as really playing at the convergence of financial services. And that has all sorts of ancillary categories that become interesting. I would say right now, cybersecurity has been a big focus area for us as a firm. And of course, that'll change over time.
When you say digital securities, like how wide of a scope does that entail? Are you talking about like maybe like stock prices or even like commodity prices or things like that being tied to some sort of blockchain or crypto environment?
I think one obvious category is just the alternatives market. And so if you're a large alts manager that runs a big credit fund or a big secondaries fund, you're probably looking at the growth of stablecoins and you're saying, well, wow, that's just distribution that I didn't know was there. I mean, look at all of the people that want to hold dollars. Would they want to hold a credit fund? Would they want to hold a private equity secondaries fund?
Right,
and
right.
If we could operationalize something like that, could we raise more capital into our alts vehicles? Could we also be more efficient with just the way that that vehicle works in terms of the secondary trading of it, in terms of what we need to stand up for infrastructure if we're relying on essentially this public infrastructure? So I think you'll see a lot of experimentation there. And I really do think that that will translate into other types of assets. Listed equities is probably the last thing to go. You know, I think it's a very complicated market structure, but
yeah, there's a lot of systems already in place that have been around for a long time. It's hard to upend something like that, right?
It's hard to upend it. It's more of a behavioral challenge, but there's other, you know, real estate is an interesting one. I think there's not, you know, a legacy DTC equivalent in that space.
I think I've seen some tokenizations of assets already in that space, or at least a project or two.
Yeah, there's certainly a lot of attempts over the years in the real estate space. There's a great company in Boston called Groma that we're involved with that is exploring launching a real estate-backed cryptocurrency. So I think you'll see a ton of innovation in that category, and it'll be interesting to see what people come up with. I think there's the thing that was really blocking this for the longest time was just the regulatory environment. And so the inability to actually launch these things in a compliant manner. And now that we're getting that regulatory clarity, I think you'll see the entrepreneurial ambition catch up to the regulatory landscape.
Well, so, I mean, we mentioned the Genius Act. I think the Clarity Act was something else that went through, or did that one go through yet, or is that being talked about? I can't remember.
Clarity Act and, you know, for those not following it day to day, the Clarity Act is also known as the Market Structure Bill. That was passed through the House of Representatives. There's a Senate version that is being concocted right now. And at some point, hopefully this fall, we would get a market structure bill that gets passed.
Is that the one that's finally going to explain to us like what these are, if they're a security, if they're an asset, if they're a commodity? Like, is it going to finally like define some of these terms?
That's probably the most important part of the bill, is just defining these things as either securities or commodities. And then as a result, which regulator oversees the spot market, right, the exchanges? How do broker dealers engage with these assets? And if things are securities, okay, well, what can you issue? How can we do that? So it's a very important bill. I'd say the level of capital formation that would happen as a result of getting a bill like that passed is difficult to overstate. I think that there's just a ton of entrepreneurial interest in launching some of these things. And so having that framework, I think, will open up the U.S. market in a way that it hasn't been before.
So the regulatory landscape then, are you involved in any of those conversations? Like, are you like trying to get your voices heard? Like, how involved are you guys in the conversations shaping these bills?
Yeah, we've become very involved over the years, I'd say, initially from a defensive posture. And so just there's a lot of things happening over the past 4 years in the United States around banks that were deplatforming our companies, around enforcement actions coming towards the broader startup community that we felt were unjust. And so we started getting very involved in that, talking about it on our podcast, having politicians come on the podcast. These days, we're talking to a lot of regulators, actually, mm-hmm. around our views on what would be good for the startup community, what would promote capital formation, which is great. I mean, if you look at the mandate of the SEC, part of it is to promote capital formation. It's to protect consumers. It's to right. promote capital formation. And that wasn't happening for a very long time. And so it's great to see that come along. But yeah, I think if you're investing in the crypto blockchain space, you better be involved, because if you're,
right.
you know, they say, if you're not, what's the saying? If you're not interested in politics, it's interested in you, I guess, the way to think about it.
The other question I have then about just, I guess, the regulatory landscape in general, like, who does anybody want control of it? Like, that's been what, as an outsider looking in, like, that's what it looks like to me, is like the SEC doesn't want it. Gary Gensler doesn't really want it. It doesn't seem like any of the regulatory agencies really want to have control of crypto. Am I misreading that? Or like, have you seen anything different with the conversations you've had?
Well, I think what is going to happen now, in my estimation, is that the commodity tokens will go under the CFTC and the things or securities will go under the SEC. And to me, that feels like a very appropriate...
Feels like a much better way to do it than trying to just lump them all into one or the other.
Yeah, that feels like the right market structure to me. And so figuring out the staffing at those agencies and how that's going to work, I think will be the next thing to figure out. But that's not a... we're not talking about rocket science here. I mean...
right.
You know, we're talking about the CFTC probably getting some resources to stand up oversight of the exchanges on the commodity side. And so to me, that's the way it unfolds. And I think we're hoping that that happens this fall.
I imagine as the clarity comes, like, people should be more excited about working with it, like, as it becomes more clear what it is, right? Like, there's just too many unknowns, I think, to really want to get, like, jump in head first.
Well, I think there's no shortage of ideas on how this should work, and they've been brewing for the past 5 or 6 years. And I'd say there's a pretty cohesive bill that just got passed out of the House that makes a lot of sense. The Senate version looks like it is very similar, but maybe with some improvements to it. So I don't think we're talking about something that is, okay, it's the first time the industry has thought about this or anything like
right.
that.
Right, no, yeah. This conversation has been going on for, like you said, at least 5 years, right?
Yeah, and I think if you just look at the types of projects that have not gotten started in the United States because there isn't clarity on, okay, if I do this, is the token itself going to be a security or a commodity? That has prevented a lot of things from getting started. And so I think the good thing now is that a lot of those voices around, okay, I'd like to build this, they're actually able to go in and talk to the SEC. And so the SEC has been, since probably February 1st here, been publishing open records on who they're meeting with and what people are coming in and asking for. And it's fascinating. I think if you just read those open letters from the SEC Crypto Working Group, you can see that we're about to have this burgeoning startup ecosystem around security tokens.
Can you read, was that on the SEC Gov website? You can find those?
Yeah, it's on the SEC's website. They're publishing every meeting they have with startups. They're publishing the records. You know, people go in with PowerPoint decks and say, here's what I'm thinking about building. What do you think? And so to be able to have that dialogue with a regulator, that didn't exist in the United States for about 4 years. And so it's great to see it.
Oh, yeah, that's amazing. Next question I have for you then, too. When I was looking through your profile, I see that not only are you working for Castle Ventures, but you're also sitting on the board of like 4 other companies.
Yeah, well, luckily I have a great team. So it's 10 of us now at Castle Island. You know, it's just Nick and I when we started. And so we try to get really involved in the businesses we invest in. So we're generally taking board seats. And that means we're playing an active role in the governance of these businesses. You know, we're writing checks and owning a portion of them. And so we're trying to help the founders really advance it forward. And so being on the board of the company, a lot of times I'd say the entrepreneurs are looking to the board members to solve problems, to solve their thorniest problems. And so a lot of it is talking through corporate strategy, talking through regulatory decisions. Hiring is a big part of it. And so one of the things we're very involved in is going out and trying to find people to join these companies as executives. And so we spend a lot of time on that.
How hard is it for some of these founders to delegate some of the work? I think that's one of the hardest things to do is to actually recognize that you need to hire somebody to come help you.
Yeah, I'd say it's a good observation because frequently it's like 6 or 12 months too late in a lot of cases. It's okay. I wish as soon as you bring in that great CFO, it's okay. I wish I did that a year earlier. I can't believe how much how much time is taken off my plate on this role. And so that's part of it, which is obviously a tricky balance. Startups, they're generally not raising tons of money out of the gate. And so you have to be efficient with your capital, but you also need to be investing in the people and probably investing in the people about 6 to 12 months before, you know, it makes sense financially in some cases.
What other advice do you give to the founders that come to you guys looking for help?
I would say, you know, transparency is always top of the list. And so every startup is a struggle, right? Like there's no clear path. I've never met a single entrepreneur that everything always went great for.
If somebody came to you and said they have no problems, you're going to be like, you're lying.
Yeah, everyone's got a problem. And so I think the best founders in our portfolio certainly are the ones that leverage their board, leverage their investors for help, leverage their advisors. And so that's a hard thing in a lot of cases. And so it's not always an easy question.
I think that just speaks to just having humility, right? You don't have to know all the answers, but you just have to be the guy that can help find where they are. You
know? Yeah. And just keep on putting one foot in front of the other, right?
Yeah.
Things go wrong always. So the project is, the technology is going to be, you know, the issue one day, the regulatory is going to be the issue one day. It's always something. And so just always, you know, putting one foot in front of the other.
So do you know what you're going to be doing at Boston Blockchain this year?
I think I'll be chatting with a lot of blockchain folks. I don't know. Has the agenda come out?
I haven't seen the agenda come out yet, but have they put you on a panel? Are they, like, have you gotten a speech prepared? Do you know what you're presenting something?
No, I told Ian I'm game for anything. So I'll be there doing something.
Well, I can't wait to see you. I got my tickets. Let's see. That's September 9th through 13th. Yeah, I'm looking forward to meeting you down there. Hopefully we can meet up for a beer somewhere.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. Should be an awesome event. Ian, team, do a great job.
What's the name of the podcast? People want to check that out?
It's On the Brink with Castle Island.
On the Brink. I'll make sure there's links for that in the episode descriptions as well. Definitely recommend checking that out. I listened to your 8-1 episode before we had the meeting here, and I actually got lost in one of Nick Carter's papers that he wrote for your blog.
Oh, good. Yeah.
So there's a lot of really good blog stuff on there too. Highly recommend checking that out. The last word on stablecoins and free banking was the one I read.
Yeah, really, that's about a 32-minute read.
Yeah. I know. Yeah, so definitely recommend checking out the stuff that Nick's put up on there. It looks like you guys got content going back years here. And there's plenty of stuff to check out. Definitely worth looking at. But Matt, thank you for your time. Is there anything you want to say to leave the audience with?
No, that's great. I'm looking forward to seeing everyone at Boston Blockchain Week. And yeah, appreciate your time, Cal.
Well, thank you very much. Looking forward to seeing you, and maybe I get Josh and you together. We can get some more Fidelity stories.
That'd be great. That'd be great.
Big thanks to Matt Walsh for diving into stablecoins, VC strategies, and the future of blockchain regulation. You can explore Castle Island Ventures at castleisland.vc and follow them at Castle Island VC on Twitter, and catch their podcast On the Brink for more industry deep dives. And don't miss Boston Blockchain Week this September. You can snag your tickets at bostonblockchainweek.com for the talks, networking, and that unbeatable crypto energy. Follow the show, share it with your blockchain buddies, and we'll catch you in the next episode. Produced by China Shop Productions.